Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight to our discussion on politics and language, and thanks to Cause Chambers Westgarth for the use of this facility. We have two speakers tonight. Barry Spurr, who was Australia's first professor of poetry and poetics. He's now semi-retired, but he's writing his memoirs, so that should be fun. And Miranda Devine, a well-known columnist at the Daily Telegraph and the Sunday Telegraph, and occasional contributor to Sky News and whatever. So we're going to start off with Miranda Devine, and then we go to Barry Spurr, and then we go to questions and discussion. Miranda Devine, thank you.
Look, if this speech was being held at the august former workplace of Professor Spurr, I would start by telling you all that this room is a safe space, and I would assure you that I would give you trigger warnings if there was anything that we said tonight that provoked anxiety. But I would ask you not to clap with your hands if there's anything we say that you approve of. Instead, I would ask you to just raise your hands in the air silently and jiggle them around. It's called jazz hands, and jazz hands is all about making sure that no neurotic people in the audience get triggered, have any anxiety that is triggered by violent sounds like hands clapping. And to start off, we would begin with a pronoun round, which basically would be me and Barry and Jared and possibly Anne just standing up in front of you and just declaring the gender with which we identify tonight. And that would just prevent any misgendering of any of us by any of you, which could provoke real psychological collapse from somebody. Now, it all sounds like a joke, but unfortunately, it's not. It's not a parody of campus life. It is the reality of campus life. Sydney University, one of the most prestigious learning institutions in the world, has succumbed to the tyranny of political correctness, which is really just an instrument of control for the authoritarian left. And there is a new mood of intellectual oppression on our campuses. Ideas, speech that might cause offence to somebody are shut down. Those who dare to express offensive ideas or who are even suspected of harbouring improper thoughts are actively persecuted. You saw the attempts last week to stop John Howard from arriving on campus at Sydney University. You saw a while ago Lieutenant Colonel Richard Kemp was stopped by pro-Palestinian protesters from addressing some Jewish students about the ethics of warfare. And it wasn't that they wanted to protest, it was that they wanted to stop anybody from even hearing what he had to say. And this is just commonplace on university campuses today. But the most egregious capitulation to campus totalitarians was the case of Barry Spurr, our guest of honour tonight, who was hounded out of Sydney University on suspicion of holding those improper thoughts. Barry Spurr was Australia's only poetry professor. He is the world's preeminent T.S. Eliot scholar. He's a man of extraordinary literary and academic accomplishment. Students used to come from all across the world just to be in his classes. And as one of those former students said, there would be no University of Sydney without men like Barry Spurr, and there would be no Australia without the Western civilization that he defends. But now there is a Sydney University without Barry Spurr. It has jazz hands and it has pronoun rounds, but no poetry professor. And why? Because somebody hacked into Barry Spurr's private email account and leaked private correspondence, which between him and a friend, in which he used politically incorrect slang to describe Muslims, Asians and women. Now, these were private emails to a friend. They were never supposed to see the light of day. They were sort of a secret blasphemy against the thought police. But when they were leaked and then published by New Matilda, Barry Spurr was denounced widely as racist, sexist, misogynist, and Islamophobic. And there were mobs of campus Trotskyists who screamed through megaphones outside Fisher Library saying that Barry Spurr was racist filth and a vile bigot. They joined with a local Greens candidate to burn him in effigy. They demanded his resignation. They descended on his office. They graffitied on his door. The ABC's Q&A program discussed this, and no one raised a murmur when Barry Spurr was described as a racist bigot. And Barry Humphries was watching all of this fuss from London, and he asked if Australia had gone slightly mad. How could anyone take such deliberate Tourette-ing seriously, he said. But Sydney University did take it very seriously. Barry Spurr was suspended, he was banned from campus, he was forced to resign, and he was silenced in a later legal settlement with the university where he had worked for 40 years, so he won't be able to tell you any of this. And of course, the reason that Barry Spurr was singled out for destruction was because he was seen as a conservative who was helping Tony Abbott in his review of the national curriculum, and he had recommended greater emphasis on the Western literary canon. For instance, Barry Spurr criticised the standard HSC English course for not having a single poet from the entire 16th, 17th or 18th centuries. He agreed to help fix the curriculum because he knew that democracy is threatened when its people are, as he put it, inarticulate in their use of language and sub-literate in their linguistic discernment. But this was all deemed to be, shock horror, a conservative position, and Barry Spurr, from then on, was a marked man. He had devoted his life to eradicating the sort of slovenly, deceitful, politically correct language which makes it easier for us to have foolish thoughts, as George Orwell put it. And then he became its victim. I defended Barry Spurr at the time on Radio National in this debate with David Hetherington, who was executive director of the progressive think tank Per Capita. He told me that universities could not tolerate professors who held improper thoughts. Quote, in positions of social and organisational leadership, people are not expected to hold discriminatory personal opinions, he said. So this is the state we are now in Australia, where people are banned for thinking the wrong thoughts. Hello, Big Brother, and hello, Barry Spurr. I'll hand over to Barry, and please put your hands in the air to make him welcome.
Thank you so much, Miranda. Thank you, Anne and Jared. And a particular thank you to Shelley Gare, who's here tonight, whose idea this originally was. I'm focusing on two related matters, language in and taken out of context, and language in our society, especially in its political domain. As anyone with an elementary knowledge of language and literature knows, words must be read in context. Language use cannot be interpreted, let alone evaluated, in a referential vacuum. The more you study language, the more aware you become of the all-important significance of contextual issues for the accurate and wise understanding of meaning. A professional lifetime spent reading, studying, teaching, and writing about poetry, the most elusive and complex of language usages, has made me acutely sensitive to the fact that we ignore context at our peril if we are to embark on intelligent conversation, intelligent interpretation, and understanding of texts, without which any reading is ignorant and potentially seriously misleading. Some common words and phrases in contemporary use demonstrate the need to determine the wider context in order to choose between alternative, even contradictory interpretations. Enormity is currently used to describe largeness. Until fairly recently, it was a negative term meaning a gross evil, and a few writers and speakers still use it in this way. So we have to be especially careful in the matter of contextualisation when we come upon it in such as a news report. For example, the enormity of the grand final crowd, or the enormity of the tsunami. Is the former a damning criticism of crowd behaviour, or merely a description of size, even celebrating the large numbers in attendance at the game? Is the latter embracing both the size of the event and the horror of its consequences? The context of the articles in which the word appears will tell us. A word that has undergone significant and lamentable change of meaning in recent times is disinterested. It has come to replace uninterested. To say everyone has observed that he is a particularly disinterested judge would once have been a high compliment, meaning that his honour's impartiality was evident. Now it would be a criticism, suggesting that the judge was disengaged from, indifferent to, the cases he was trying. But some writers would still use the word correctly, and context alone would reveal which meaning and therefore which evaluation was intended. In vernacular speech, the element of humour or its absence is yet another contextual nuance we must be alert to if we are to read or hear and interpret correctly. A good example is the word bastard. In an angry interchange, it is a savage criticism, while in the jocular phrase, "you lucky bastard," said to someone who has won a prize, it is affectionate, with a touch of wry mock envy. Gay is the example of the necessity of contextualisation that everyone, I presume, now knows. William Wordsworth, amongst the Dancing Daffodils, wrote that a poet could not but be gay in such a jocund company. He's telling us that he is happy, not that he is a homosexual. The gay hussars of the eponymous operetta, a bachelor gay of the early 20th century popular song, and the gay divorcee of the musical film of that name from the 30s were anything but gay in the modern sense. It wasn't until the latter part of the 20th century that gay, in general usage, took on its specific and now dominant connotation of sexual identity and also became a noun, as in the only gay in the village. The character who utters that line repeatedly and bemoans his condition in the satirical series Little Britain is anything but gay in the old sense of the word. The humour depends upon the recognition of that linguistic tension. This gay is not gay. Then words have different valuations in distinct cultural groupings. Nigger is not derogatory in African American rap music today, but unspeakable elsewhere, except at the Sydney Institute. So what Christopher Hitchens calls an epidermal subdivision can be yet another contextual determinant of meaning and further of acceptability with regard to whether a word or phrase is offensive or not remotely offensive. Malaysian Prime Minister Najib reportedly lashed out at white people in August 2015, accusing them of trying to bring down his government. If a white PM lashed out at black people, he would be denounced as a racist and even be hounded from office. But the racism accusation was not even mentioned in the reporting of Mr. Najib's attack. After Andrew Hastie's victory in the September 2015 by-election for the federal seat of Canning, the Sydney Morning Herald letters editor had no qualms in publishing a contribution criticising the appointment of, quote, another right-wing white male Christian, unquote, to Canberra. The writer managing, in the course of just one sentence, to be racist, sexist, and as if through guilt by association with Hastie's regrettable whiteness, maleness, and alleged right-wingery, to vilify the man's religious commitment too. Were someone to write to the paper, perhaps someone might try it, condemning the election of a left-wing black female Muslim, it would be unthinkable that the letter would even be printed.
Once again, we must have recourse to context to understand the inclusion and the omission in such cases. The highly selective censoriousness of current political correctness would explain the editorial decision in such an instance. The known beliefs and teachings of an individual can also be of contextual importance with regard to the assessment, in acceptance or denunciation of what they have written. In a private letter from Karl Marx to Engels, Marx called Ferdinand LaSalle, founder of the German Social Democratic Party, a Jewish nigger. If someone were to write that phrase today in private correspondence similarly made public, the contemporary followers of Marx would be in the vanguard of those calling for the lynching of the racist bigot. Yet would they denounce Marx himself or construct an historical pre-Holocaust excuse for him? Yet no such defence would be mounted for a notorious conservative such as T.S. Eliot, who has been pilloried for decades as a loathsome anti-Semite, books have even been devoted to the subject, as a result of a few comments about Jews in his writings from the 1920s and 30s. Other writers from the past, such as Eliot's contemporary D.H. Lawrence, and as we've seen, Karl Marx, have not been reviled for expressing similar and indeed even more extreme views. So one has to seek out larger contexts of such men's lives and times and opinions to see why some are vilified and others exonerated for using exactly the same words, expressing exactly the same attitudes. Condemnation or exoneration can have less to do with what a person says than whom the person is who has made the remark that ignites opprobrium. Numerous examples can be found in our own day of this variation of assessment, as those who police thought and speech apply their judgments selectively, depending on the more general palatability to them, or otherwise, of a writer's or speaker's worldview. As gimlet-eyed, the pursed-lipped self-appointed language censors seek out any sexist, racist, culturalist, nationalist, regionalist, ageist, lookist, ableist, sizist, speciists, try saying that before breakfast, intellectualist, socio-economicist, ethnocentrist, phallocentrist, heteropatriarchalist, or any other hissing ist ripe for shaming with a zeal that would not have been out of place in witch-hunting Salem. The same double standard can apply even to the titles of works of art. It would be unimaginable now for the nigger of the Narcissus, generally accepted to be the best work of Joseph Conrad's early period, to be set for study by any syllabus committee for high school or university English literature students, merely because of one word in its title, thus depriving those students of exposure to a classic of our language. It would be another book for burning on the contemporary bonfire of the profanities and for listing in today's index of prohibited texts. Trigger warnings will need to be inserted into Conrad's masterpiece, Heart of Darkness, as the word nigger is used several times there. Such warnings prejudicing impressionable minds against the author and so inhibiting their appreciation of a work which, ironically, is a critique of colonialism and racial abuse. But there would be no reluctance in listing and prescribing for study for students of visual art the Piss Christ, the photograph by American artist Andre Serrano, which depicts the second person of the Holy Trinity totally immersed in a glass of the artist's urine. No trigger warnings needed in that case. Any Christian who found such a listing offensive would be smartly ticked off with reference to Voltaire, I disagree with what you say, and so on, nous sommes Charlie, and so on. Principles which, for some reason that only the most tortured casuistry could support, would be withheld from the nigger of the Narcissus. In the context of private discourse, as in correspondence, nuances of usage can occur, leading to errors of misreading and judgment on the part of those who, having entered uninvited upon the context of an individual's privacy, misinterpret, through inevitable ignorance of those nuances, what was not only never intended for public consumption, but not for reading by anyone other than the letter's recipient. Today, the protection of and respect for the once cherished rights to privacy and freedom of speech in private in particular have been undermined to the point of annihilation, especially in the spying on and theft of email correspondence. In the 1960s, it was claimed that the personal is political. Today, the personal and private have not only become public property, but are routinely held up for judgment and condemnation by the self-righteous arbiters of correct opinion. So the matter of context becomes very important in assessing the validity of these readings of private material, never intended for public dissemination, but publicly exposed. the racist, sexist and pornographic poem King Bolo and His Big Black Queen, a work described by Louis Menand as consisting of unredeeming explicitness that would almost make a rapper blush, was initiated by the young T.S. Eliot and bandied backwards and forwards in private correspondence with his fellow American friends Ezra Pound and Conrad Aiken. Would anybody in their right mind, and not motivated by sheer malice, maintain for one moment that this crazy Touretting was expressive of the essential mind of the Nobel laureate, member of the Order of Merit, and the most influential and arguably the greatest poet of the 20th century, and the author of a vast range of extraordinarily influential literary, critical and sociocultural books and essays, and an enormous quantity of private correspondence? It is preposterous even to suggest it, but as Christopher Hitchens has argued, this is the common procedure now of the character assassins of muckraking journalism and antisocial media, who would pluck King Bolo from the complex context of the entirety of Eliot's life and extraordinary achievement in poetry and literature, claim, for whatever ideological purpose that destroying Eliot's reputation might achieve, that it amounted to the fullness and entire compass of his thought and character, and condemn him and everything about him on the basis of it. The reception of the posthumously published letters of the poet Philip Larkin and Kingsley Amis provides a striking example of this disreputable procedure, now commonplace and burgeoning. Their correspondence began during their undergraduate years at Oxford and retained an undergrad naughtiness, becoming more obscene and politically incorrect as the years went by and as the public world, in contrast, progressively submitted to the censorious dictates of the totalitarian empire of offence and Peter Hitchens's dictatorship of rage. With the internet set up as the pillory, those exposed to public shaming for uttering an allegedly racist word or sexist phrase or daring to crack a joke, even amongst friends in personal correspondence, are vilified in a language of an intensity and extremity which once would have been reserved for murderers, rapists and child molesters, and in old Puritan times for fornicating adulterers. People, in other words, who had actually committed an offence, rather than having expressed an opinion or had private communication with their intimate circle. The correspondence of friendship and connections, Christopher Hitchens writes, demonstrates that these can even come to depend upon a sort of shared language or slang, a private language, and he demonstrates this in some examples from his long friendship with fellow writer Martin Amis, son of Kingsley. In their case, the linguistic expression of their bond is as often as not ribald and, by current thought policed standards, offensive, but to the participants, consenting adults in private, it is affectionate and hilarious. Such verbal in-jokes are often carried on and evolved over years as the participants strive to outdo one another in the use of particular locutions, a very familiar phenomenon inevitably in wordsmiths' correspondence, and seek to improve on its edginess. If we are to presume, and by what authority, to enter into judgment of such material which was never intended for our eyes, and thereby of these individuals, and with a presumption and impertinence that astonishes, assess their moral rectitude or lack of it, then recognition of this elusive contextual element is vital and indeed should give a serious pause before proceeding to any commentary, let alone denunciation. It is almost the definition of a private joke that its humour is lost on outsiders. But now, in the neo-Puritan dispensation of the moral police, where only acceptable subjects are approved for jokes, transgressive wit, even in private, is damned as offensive. It is indeed an extraordinary historico-cultural phenomenon to see the Western world submitting willingly to this humourless regime of censorship, Barry Humphrey's finger-wagging Puritanism. When we consider the protracted battles that were fought against censorship through the 20th century. Two such champions were Virginia Woolf and E.M. Forster, writing a joint public letter at the time of the attempted banning of the lesbian novel The Well of Loneliness. "The free mind," they wrote, "has access to all the knowledge and speculation of its age, and nothing cramps it like a taboo." As in an individual's published statements and writings, so within the corpus of a person's private correspondence, there can be a vast variation of thoughts and feelings. And indeed, if we peruse such material over several decades, remarkable changes can occur in one person's stance on a variety of matters. Sheer common sense warns us that reading this or that letter from a correspondent, plucked from a lifetime of letter writing and, what must never be forgotten, with a particular recipient in mind, would give a very incomplete insight into the totality of the person's mind and range of opinions. When the American poet Walt Whitman was charged with inconsistency of thought, he responded, "Do I contradict myself? Very well then, I contradict myself. I am large, I contain multitudes." Yet in our debased media culture, so shallow and instantaneous as Don Watson described it in an interview the other day, and in what passes for public debate now, in which ad hominem pseudo-argument and character assassination are the principal modes, a linguistic gotcha moment can define and destroy a life. The now classic example of this egregious process is the case of Professor Sir Tim Hunt, Nobel Laureate, Fellow of the Royal Society and, until he was forced to resign, Professor at London University. Attending a conference in South Korea, Sir Tim made the flippant observation in passing that female laboratory staff had a tendency to fall in love with their male superiors. Little did the professor realise as he gave voice to this statement, which he said was meant to be a joke but is patently of unspeakable wickedness, that he was under surveillance. An agent of the Thought and Speech Police, avid for verbal cleansing, in Clive James's telling phrase, was in the audience. Instead of taking Sir Tim to task for his statement then and there and being done with it, this evangelist of shaming saw to it that he was denounced on antisocial media for his repellent sexism, and the execration went, as they say, viral. Without missing a beat, the authorities of London University, far from coming to the defence of their distinguished professor, told him that he must resign immediately, or they would dismiss him, in order to protect the good name of the institution, which, as it turns out, as a result of their actions, has been seriously tarnished. Subsequently, the university said that it needed to get rid of Sir Tim in order to quell the baying mob. So resign he did. His career and reputation are in ruins. "I am finished," he has said. "I had hoped to do a lot more to help promote science in this country and in Europe, but I cannot see how that can happen. I have become toxic. I've been hung out to dry by academic institutes who have not even bothered to ask me for my side of affairs." Numerous fellow Nobel laureates came to Sir Tim's defence, but to no avail. The punishment inflicted on this eminent 72-year-old professor for a 39-word joke would appear to be a tad out of kilter with his crime. But that Sir Tim had in fact broken no law and harmed nobody was of no concern to his persecutors. Richard Dawkins, in a letter to the Times, commented, "Disproportionate would be a huge underestimate of the baying witch hunt that the anecdote unleashed among our academic thought police. Nothing less than a feeding frenzy of mob-rule self-righteousness." But the digital lynch mob had spoken. Causa finita est. Merely express an opinion that might question, say, same-sex marriage, or even register the slightest reservation about it, and you will be denounced in the mainstream media as a bigoted homophobe engaging in hate speech while you drown in the bile spewed up in the antisocial media vomitorium. Germaine Greer has said that if we really believe in free speech, then we have to be prepared to hear things we would prefer not to hear and to debate them. Indeed, the contemptible spectacle of Professor Hunt's downfall was followed soon after by the firestorm which engulfed Greer herself, who made the mistake of expressing an opinion about gender reassignment that was not in lockstep with the jackbooted censors of incorrect thought. She opined that men who became women by this process are not real women. Immediately, with that precipitate rush to judgment and condemnation that characterises these processes now, her university, Cambridge, withdrew the offer of an honorary degree it was planning to confer on her, and Cardiff University, where she was scheduled to deliver a guest lecture, warned her that she would be could be physically assaulted if she attended the campus. All this as the consequence of speaking her mind. Exasperated, Greer expostulated, "I was expressing an opinion." An interviewer asked her if she was astonished by the university's responses. Unfortunately, she replied ruefully, "No." Speaking at the Cambridge University Union's 200th anniversary in 2015, Germaine Greer stood before a banner celebrating the landmark anniversary, proudly proclaiming 200 years of free speech. Yet within a few months, when she was exercising that very freedom, her university condemned her for it. At least the Holy Office of the Inquisition went through the motions of investigation, deliberation and debate before burning heretics at the stake. Today, instantaneous conviction without trial, shrill execration and excommunication from the institution are routine, as a phrase or a comment becomes the pillory for the annihilation of a human being. Winston Churchill once said, "A lie travels halfway round the world while the truth is putting on its trousers." Now, truth hasn't even got out of bed before mendacious libels have circled the globe to remain there in cyberspace in eternum. That blameless sounding, but in fact morally culpable constituency, the silent majority, have much to answer for in allowing the toxic tyranny of verbal cleansing so to assault the public discourse of our polity as to destroy one of the essential freedoms of a democracy, to the point now where this toxicity has become, in my assessment at least, an irreversible plague. They've stood dumbly by, while individuals have been monstered by the media merely for expressing their points of view, even in private. Yet were one of these silent witnesses to be subjected to being eaten alive for his or her opinions, they would be the first to cry foul. For evil to thrive, all that is necessary is for men and women to remain silent in the face of it. Nothing is more conducive to tyranny than a cowed and silenced populace. Of particular concern in this issue, indeed, is the degree to which universities, once the committed defenders of the freedoms of a free society, and even such venerable foundations as Cambridge, as we've seen in the Greer case, have been degraded into centres of social engineering. So grim is the situation that George Steiner recently found it necessary to affirm what once would have been taken for granted. A true university, he wrote in 2013, serves neither political purposes nor social programs, necessarily partisan and transitory. Above all, it rebukes censorship and correctness of any kind, and it should honour anarchic provocation. All that Professor Steiner is saying is that this is what the word university means, a place where any and every opinion can be voiced and open to reason, debate and discussion. A university, properly about its business, teaches students how to think, not what to think. A friend, who has published several campus novels over the years, has told me that the genre is being killed off. For what is happening in and to universities today, he opined, is far more grotesque and bizarre than any fictional or satirical concoctions a novelist could devise. Today, as the Ayatollahs of political correctness roam about, seeking whom they may devour and silence, there are more taboos than ever. Michael Learning, the cartoonist, has somehow managed, to date at least, not to be silenced. In a recent cartoon, he nailed what has become of our Australian democracy, with his lovable big-nosed everyman character bedevilled and oppressed by our anti-social discourse. It is, Learning writes, the sound of constant bickering, besmirching, denouncing, attacking. It's a lovely sound and a wonderful influence on the human heart. The details are forgotten, and what remains is the spirit of tribal aggression, pomposity, and mean stupidity. It is the tone that will rule the country. It already does rule the country. Dr. Karen Phelps called the other day for a nuanced debate on the matter of immigration. How can you have any kind of debate, courteous discussion, rational conversation, let alone a nuanced version of these, when public and political discourse has been degraded into abusive name-calling and demonisation of your opponent, and when even in the principal setting for national debate, the federal parliament, you have all the representatives of a political party walk out of the chamber because they are not prepared to listen to the views of another elected representative of the people with which they happen to disagree? That so many politicians and commentators in the political sphere, such as Phelps, are calling repeatedly now for reasoned debate on a range of topics indicates how impossible it is becoming to achieve such a thing. Of course, these problems are not confined to Australia. Christopher Hitchens speaks of what he calls the norm of the pseudo-left new style, whereby if your opponent thought he had identified your lowest possible motive, he was quite certain that he had isolated the only real one. This vulgar method, Hitchens writes, which is now the norm and standard in much non-left journalism as well, is designed to have the effect of making any noisy moron into a master analyst. Further, once the noisy moron has sounded the public alarm from the exalted position of impeccable moral rectitude that has given him or her the authority to cast the first stone at other people's terrible sins, the material will be reprinted again and again by the lazy and or the malicious. As John Ronson puts it in his bestseller, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, the now commonplace process of media lynching, what he calls our shaming frenzy, is like a distorting mirror at a fun fair, taking human nature and making it look monstrous. One can hardly expect the rabid ideologues and the fanatics of antisocial media today to have any respect for the courtesies of debate, let alone the subtleties of argument, language in context, and their analysis. But when we reach the point where people reputedly of higher learning are similarly even willfully ignorant of such courtesies and complexities, and what is more, are prepared to take their cues from those very ideologues and fanatics, we have indeed entered a new dark age. To conclude, the lynch mob shaming in which modern democracies demonstrably revel is routinely, spuriously justified by its promoters as being in the public interest. In fact, nothing could be more detrimental to the common good of society, given the prejudiced selectivity, interpretative distortions, and malicious exaggerations which the lynching leaders promote. Their ultimate goal, now clearly in sight, is to silence all discourse, public or private, that does not accord with approved opinion. How can this method, the propagation of falsehood, and this outcome of silencing a people, be to anybody's, let alone the community's, advantage? Such an oppression of language and suppression of countercultural ideas, whether with regard to the personal or the political sphere, degrades any free society to a domain of monocultural fascism beyond the wildest dystopic imaginings of Aldous Huxley and George Orwell. Big brother and big sister aren't merely watching you, keeping you under surveillance even in your most intimate and private moments and matters. They are at the ready to rip out your tongue. It is a situation that is evil beyond words. Thank you.
Many thanks to Barry Spur for an important and beautifully written speech, and to Miranda Devine for her telling and amusing comments. So we come to questions and discussion. There are a lot of people here, and we've got about 20 minutes, so I'd ask you to keep your comments brief or question brief. I'll just start off to Barry Spur. As you know, in the 60s and in the 70s into the 80s, there was a lot of left-wing protest at universities. There was a lot of attempt to shut down debate, like Malcolm Fraser at Monash University in the 70s, and Quang, the South Vietnamese counsellor at La Trobe University in the early 70s. By and large, university administrations handled this kind of protest weakly, but they did indicate that they were opposed to it. It was indicated this is not the way you behave at a university. What seems to have changed over four decades that you've got this now situation where some university administrations actually effectively support this kind of silencing?
Yes.
What's the change?
Yes, it's a very interesting phenomenon, and Gerard has put it exactly in the time frame from the late 60s when I was an undergraduate through to the present time. And it's a complex issue, and I've thought about it, and I'm writing about it in my memoirs. But in simple terms, I think what happened and what has happened is this, that there was this enormous amount of revolt and radicalism in the late 60s. 1968 is the year that's often focused on, isn't it, because of the revolt in Paris. And then there was the Vietnam moratorium business here in Australia particularly, and the upsets and the turmoils on American campuses at much the same time. And following very soon after that was the enormous expansion of universities and of enrolments at universities, and the need, of course, to have staff, tutors and lecturers and so on. And so there was a massive hiring of staff in the early 70s into the 80s. I was appointed at 26, which would be unheard of today, but that was the kind of age people were being appointed at then, though I was not one of the Woodstock generation in any ideological sense, as you can imagine. But the... I said people can change their opinions. I even had hair then. But so what has happened is that while the rulers of the universities in the late 60s through to the 70s put up to a large degree with the radicalisation, the radical and revolting movements, the students are revolting and so on, though not approving of it, as Jared said, to a large extent, and the interruption of people, I can remember people coming to speak on campus who were interrupted and denounced and what have you, there was a general sense of tolerance of a wide range of views. But I think now what happened in the 80s and 90s and so on is that many of those radicals became members of staff, and they're now, of course, people who've moved to high positions, and while there's still some variety and some breadth of opinions and ideologies at university, that background has now become the dominant one. And that, along with our general climate in the society of political correctness, has reached the point now where anything that is countercultural in the sense of critical of political correctness and what have you has to be suppressed and denounced the moment it appears.
Could I start by saying I agree totally with Jared that this was an important presentation, and you're quite right to air your views. And my own opinion is that some of the things that you've said are correct. But I'm afraid I have to say that two of your examples are not correct. Let me start by saying I'm a professor at the University of Cambridge. I'm a fellow of the Royal Society. I'm a member of Clare College, just like Tim Hunt, and I know Tim. You're correct that Tim made remarks, trivial remarks, that should have been forgotten. Totally correct. You're totally correct that the woman complained and that shouldn't have happened. But the next point is that Tim, on hearing that, immediately resigned his position. The administration knew nothing about it. They did not throw him out. They objected to his resigning, and they said, we wanted to continue you. It was the vice chancellor had never even heard of this, that Tim has gone. So that's not correct.
We've got to be brief here.
Okay. Yeah, okay. And the next point is there's something like, it varies from year to year, 100 people put up for honorary degrees in Cambridge. 8 are selected by a committee. Jermaine never appeared on those 8. She may have been in a discussion, but she missed out in the 100. There's actually no way that 8, once they're put forward, that anybody could have taken. So she was thought not to be worthy amongst the 100. But I'm afraid those are important aspects of your example.
Well, I'll just reply to the second one. I'm simply relying on what Jermaine herself said. She said that the proposal for her to be put up for an honorary doctorate was cancelled once she'd made those remarks. That's what she said, so I'm only repeating what she said.
She may have been one of those...
And in regard to Sir Tim Hunt, he himself said, and I quoted what he said, that none of the academic institutes came to his defence. I've been hung out to dry, he said. So, I mean, he shouldn't have said that if that wasn't the case.
Yeah, we can't continue. You had a fair go, and now we're moving on. Yep. Yes.
Well, I'm afraid this might be more a statement than
a question. That's okay, provided it's a brief statement. Okay.
Brief statement, yes. All right. Very good. One, the river that runs through all this seems to be the fallacy, philosophic fallacy, of thinking that one swallow makes a summer, or 100 swallows make a summer. Barry queried the idea that you could go back and forth in letters to people, and that could destroy your entire life, and that's true. But in fact, what the young particularly and what universities are failing to draw attention to is the fact that many, many instances of so-called bad speech or iniquitous speech do not make the total man or total woman. And it's time that people made a case for that, that 100 swallows do not make a summer.
Okay. Barry, do you want to respond to that?
No, I agree.
Okay, yes, now,
but Miranda may well want to answer.
Do you want to, Miranda?
No, yeah. I do too.
Yes, we've got to be brief. Yes.
Given what you've said, might you regard the possibility of a Trump presidency a possibly unpleasant but necessary cleansing of society?
Okay. such a headline.
Yes, Jared has warned me that all of this is on the public record, so I decline to answer.
Hang on, here I'm coming.
Thank you, Professor Spur. I'm listening to your speech. I kept thinking of my own days at Sydney Uni in the early 70s studying literature. And one of the great things I recall was not just studying everything from the classics, Michael Wilding lecturing us about Paradise Lost and then about Raymond Chandler and Cronenberg fiction, but the debate, the tension that existed in literary criticism, the great schools of thought of Leavis and others of Northrop Frye. It seems to me from listening to you that those days are gone, but you despair about, the study of literary criticism, for instance, is such an essential part of also studying literature. And I'm wondering if you could comment about how is that going, or how are things in literary criticism in terms of the literature as distinct from the politics, if you like.
Well, what has happened in general terms is that English studies have become cultural studies, and so much of the theory that is approved is theory which promotes a particular ideological and culturally acceptable view. So there's feminist literary criticism, for example, Marxist literary criticism, but even in your day, which was my day also, there were these various schools, and the Leavis School, we had a bit of dispute in Sydney University in the mid-60s as the Leavisites were standing up against the rest of them and what have you. So I think that's a wonderful aspect of university life. Let it thrive, let there be discussion, let there be debate. I was in the philosophy department at Sydney as an undergraduate also, until it broke in half, and there was a very vigorous debate there, and most of it was, though passionate, it was reasonable and gentlemanly and ladylike, if I can be politically correct in using both genders. One has to be so careful these days, as T.S. Eliot says. As with the general climate in education, right across the board, not just in the universities and not just in humanities, but in the schools as well, where some terrifying things are happening, but that's a topic for another day, there is just this growing monochromism of outlook and the correct response that is required and the appropriate text that will bolster that response. So it's part of this whole change, which Jared mentioned in his first comment there, that's been happening now over about half a century. So that wonderful plurality that you're referring to has largely gone.
Can I ask a question about the medium rather than the message? To my mind, some of this is happening, this intolerance and this coarsening of the way in which people deal with different opinions. It's happening also because of the way we send our communication out. Social media allows people to stay in their own little bubble. And what is also happening is that, you can expand on this for me, it seems to me that people in high places quickly think that their politicians have got to win an election, and suddenly they think all the noise is against them and they've got to quickly change tact and try and please the mob. Mm. To what extent is this the phenomenon of the new way of communicating? Social media, the fact that we can choose what we want to hear and not listen to everything, whatever.
Maybe you'd like to answer that, Miranda, would you? You're more up on these things than me.
Look, the anti-social media, I think, is a fabulous description. But also Barry mentioned in his comments that the silent majority has a lot to answer for. And you now have this opportunity via social media to have an enormous influence and to speak to, countless people. And so I think that perhaps As a new generation comes of age that is au fait with social media and doesn't think of it as the enemy, perhaps there will be a corrective as the silent majority does have more to say, because at the moment social media is controlled by a sort of a cabal that's sort of chattering classes, the people who already have control of the sort of forms of communication. So, and one good thing I can tell you is that when I left home today, there were two Sydney University students at my dining table studying for a commercial law exam, and I just asked them in passing what was the sort of oppressive atmosphere at Sydney University, and they both knew about Barry Spur, and They told me that in the recent Sydney University elections for the editorship of Oniswa, the campus organ, which is just, you know, the biggest tool of oppression of all, and you know, free speech, no way. There was a group called Time, which was up against a group called Wet and a group called Sin. And Time, which was all about breaking it open and allowing, you know, proper discourse and debate and stopping the outrage industry, they got the majority of votes. They got 1,800 votes, which was amazing in such an apathetic group. Unfortunately, Sin and Wet, which apparently is some sexual reference which I don't want to know about, they combined their votes and they did win. But we had there, we had the Labor students, the Liberal students, combining to try and crush this sort of new totalitarianism on campus. So there is good news there.
Now we're rapidly coming to the end. We're going to go Jeff, Keith and Harold, and then we'll see how we go. We've got to be brief. So, Jeff.
To what extent do you think that the dominance of public funding of university has contributed to this? In the days when the universities depended a lot on private funding, either from the individuals and the students themselves contributing or businesses contributing, the universities had to have an eye that they don't now.
Yes, I it's not an area I'm expert in, but I'm sure that you're onto the money there, so to speak, that the most important matter for universities now is to be funded by the government and to receive the fullest amount of funding, and that includes taking as many students as possible and falling into line with what is acceptable by the government standards and education ministers' standards and education bureaucrats' standards, and again filtering through and becoming senior in that area are people who've come up through this radical tradition, and even on the conservative side of politics as well. So I think that's got a lot to do with it. Yes.
Keith.
When you were so unceremoniously dismissed from the university, I tried to publicise...
I resigned before they dismissed me.
I'm sorry.
Yes. I didn't give them the chance.
I'm sorry. When this happened, I tried to publicise the fact that the person who had exposed your emails to New Matilda, Wendy Baker, who was in the journalism school at University of Technology Sydney, had herself at the time on her website, was bragging about her career as a left-wing radical. And one of the illustrations she had was a full-page picture from one of her student publications where she published the poem Eskimo Nell. This struck me as Wendy Bacon pretending to be morally outraged about the innocent comments that you had made in a private matter to her own... track record of publishing what must surely be the most vilest misogynist poem ever put on online. In fact, it's online now, you can read it. And Wendy didn't publish it herself on a website, but all you had to do was Google Eskimo Nell, and there it was. And what this struck me about this issue was that it's not the moral content of what you were talking about that was the matter, it was an attempt to get rid of you. And it's a tactic that I've seen over the last 30 or 40 years used against anybody who doesn't toe the left-wing line. It's a form of reminiscent of the show trials of Joseph Stalin. It's a way of getting rid of anybody who doesn't agree with the left and to make sure that everyone's on the same page politically.
Okay, right. Response, anyone?
Bravo.
Okay. Well, we're getting to the end because I've got to go home and read Eskimo Nell, but which is now online. I didn't know that. Harold.
Well done, Barry and Miranda. Great speeches and very interesting. Einstein predicted once that he felt that technology, he feared that technology would advance to a point where we would lose our human interaction and that we'd end up with a generation of idiots. Combined with the fact that our children didn't learn any grammar or spelling, and that the fact that so many now just sit in front of screens all day with no oral or oral interaction, do you fear that the day of this generation of idiots is nigh.
You're the mothers. I'll let you.
Well, it just reminded me of a story I read today about in Tokyo. They've created these robots, they're companion robots, so that lonely people can have a robot that talks to them and can interact and give sort of semi-human conversation. This is on an island with just, you know, millions of people crammed in together, doing their best to avoid each other. So, I don't know, I think a teacher once said to me, I asked if there was a difference between my older son's cohort and the youngest one, which was 4 years, and she said yes, that they were lacking empathy, the younger ones, because they spent their life on screens and didn't learn to read human faces.
Just a final question to Miranda, I think, because we've virtually run out of time. Tell us about the atmosphere in the media, because a lot of the young students now go into media. Now you work at News Corp, but you have worked at Fairfax Media. I mean, to what extent is this... Is what Barry's been talking about tonight, moving into applied media?
Oh, well, I mean, of course, media drives it. The entire culture, a media culture, is one of oppression and closing down of certain ideas. The most egregious and obvious one at the moment, of course, is same-sex marriage. You wouldn't find an editor, I don't think, or a news producer in town who is against same-sex marriage, or who even regards any allowing the expression of an anti, or not even an anti, but a sort of supportive traditional marriage line as being worthwhile or useful. And so you're not getting much of a debate in there. But, I mean, there are other things. So climate change is an example. And the ABC and Fairfax Media obviously are the paragons of virtue in this regard. But News Corp has moved just in the time that I've, last 6 years that I've been there, incredibly. It's been revolutionised. There's a website called news.com.au, which is the highest trafficked website in the country. And it is a, you know, it's a News Corp publication, very successful, and it is the expressions, the ideology there is indistinguishable from BuzzFeed or The Guardian and so on. So, there's not much diversity of opinion there, and I think the question about Donald Trump's an example here of. Where you just to express any support for Donald Trump in the media, you're automatically just a lunatic and a barbarian. And my point is, he is a barbarian, but only a barbarian can tackle political correctness, because most people just want to be polite.
Well, we're always polite and courteous at the Sydney Institute, and we do have people here of many different views, as those of you who are our members know. And it's been terrific tonight to have Barry Spurr talking on a really important topic with historical knowledge and current awareness, and a very important paper. It'll be published in the Sydney Papers online, and it'll be on our podcast tomorrow, and Channel 648's here as well. And thanks to Miranda, who was one of my favourite columnists at the Daily Telegraph and the Sunday...
My favourite.
Your favourite. One of my favourite. You've got to be careful here. some of my best friends are columnists, you know. And also someone who is always prepared to speak her mind and to speak out forcefully in a really important column in Australia's either major or second major selling newspaper, certainly the biggest selling newspaper in Sydney. There's a flyers here for the book that's just been done. Can I just have it? The Free Mind, Essays and Poems in Honour of Barry Spurr. We couldn't get copies of the book tonight because it's difficult to get from overseas, but there are flyers here if you want to get it, which is an important book. So all I say tonight is to, finally, thanks to Barry, as well as, of course, to Miranda, and we'd love to have you back when you do your memoirs. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.